Good afternoon. Good afternoon. One more time. Good afternoon. Awesome. Energy. Welcome to SSH Tips and Tricks. This is a general overview on some of the fun things that we can do with SSH. Some of you may be familiar with these. Some of you may have advanced use cases. I do want you to share. Do ask questions. But note that it's going to be a fairly comprehensive coverage, so I may defer answers to a later part of the presentation. Also, this is my second public speaking appearance, so please have mercy. The audio is being recorded, so if you do ask a question, please make sure I repeat it so that the audio can pick that up. So I'll begin. I want to start with why I think SSH is fun. I think SSH is fun because it can really save your bacon. One of the first things I was doing in the world of Linux was setting up a change root jail. And the fun thing about change root jails, you set aside a little user space area so that when somebody's using your service, they can only see a certain amount of stuff. And the problem with only seeing a certain amount of stuff is if it doesn't have the environment there, if it doesn't have what it needs, then it won't work. So you've got to create a little section of your file system that mimics the whole system. And as you're doing this, you've got your local path, your relative path, and you've got your absolute path. What's the difference between these two? Exactly. And what happens when you forget or add the leading slash at the wrong time? Well, if you're like me, you end up deleting all of user. Start of a fun day. So SSH came in. I was actually setting up two systems. I was testing and building on one and then was going to implement on the second. So real quick SSH, SCP actually, I was able to restore everything over. Knowing that one binary gave me quite a bit of flexibility, quite a bit of capability, led me down the path of trying to figure out, well, let's maximize this tool as much as we can. So if I ask anyone in this room, what is SSH, this is probably the answer that you're going to give me. It's true, nothing wrong with it, can't complain about it, but it's really subtle in how it presents the material, mostly because it's read this way. Secure remote command line access, and that's absolutely true, but it does a heck of a lot more. So, caveat for the whole presentation, there's going to be some version differences, your mileage may vary, there's OS differences, there's version differences, there's daemon configurations. So the point of all this presentation is to get some good ideas, figure out what's really nice, figure out, oh wow, that's even possible, and then go home and try it for yourself. Using it verbatim, if that works for you, great. But if not, it may be my fault, but it also may be, you know, the system you're working on. And also another caveat, just because it has secure in the name, be careful of what you're doing. Part of this presentation is hopefully going to make you more cognizant of how SSH works, why it works, and again, just because it has secure in the name, you can still bork some things up. Said another way, Unix gives you all the rope you want to hang yourself. So basic example, we've all seen this. We've all done this. We're on host A, we SSH host B, we type in our password, hit enter, boom, we're on host B. Okay, most of us use it like this. We're on the system, we do this, we do that, we run some commands, we make a mess, and then we exit. Well, if you only have one thing you want to do, you can tell SSH to do it for you. Here we're telling SSH to go to this remote machine, do one thing for us. And notice it says a friend's computer. That's technically wrong. You do this in a test environment, or else you lose friends quickly. So you're on a machine, you run something nifty. Oops, wrong machine. Well, boom. We just took the trick we learned running that one command. Now we add a little bit of bash to season it up, and voila, it becomes run something nifty on the remote machine. So a nice little trick, you're running along, you're doing your thing, you forget you're on the wrong machine, nice way to save yourself. Second usage scenario, let's consider, hey, you like Wireshark, you like working remotely, can we combine the two? The first way of combining it would be X forwarding. And it's just dash X option on your command line. So SSH dash X, host B, and there you go. On the left, we've got your local machine. On the right, we've got your remote machine. And here, we're just issuing the extern command, and we see it forward. If we had done this with Wireshark, then all of a sudden, your Wireshark window, which would normally appear on your remote machine, is now appearing on your local machine. You receive results. You filter with all the wonderful tools that Wireshark offers you. You're having fun. And that's great, but there's some caveats to that. What if X or Wireshark are not installed on your remote machine? Could be difficult. What if you have a terribly slow connection and getting all that traffic, all that graphical traffic across it can be slow? Bash input redirection saves us here. So here, we go to host A, we execute our command, and then we pipe it back to our local machine, and we display it with Wireshark. So TCP dump, great command line utility, it's all happening, command line on the remote machine, and then it comes back here, and we dump it into Wireshark. Pop quiz, why not port 22? Answer. Exactly. So you're really going to spam yourself with what you want to do. Also, sudo. In this particular use case, since we're running the command, the SSH command is a one-off, we want to make sure sudo has no password option configured for this particular example. So we've done single commands. Can we do multiple commands on multiple remote machines? Can we do a single command on multiple remote machines at once? Well, we've used bash input redirection. We've used the bang bang operator to go ahead and repeat a command. Well, we can also just do a loop in bash. Pretty basic, serial, but it'll get it done for you. Two other options. The T command. The T command is usually used for redirecting output to a file and to something else because you want to capture that. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the case. The greater than parentheses operator actually opens that process up as a file. The echo and T are writing to that file, and now we're writing to three machines. The P command is available in a couple places. I'd recommend the more utils package. It does the same thing that T does, except instead of writing to multiple files, it writes to multiple processes. And there we go. We're writing one command to three different hosts. It's automatically happening for us. There are plenty of packages out there specifically designed for this use case and scenario. Go forth, have fun, learn them, mess around with them. A friend of mine wanted me to make the caveat that PD shell, be careful, it can only work up to about 10,000 machines. That's a problem for him, not necessarily for me. The caution that I will make, though, if you think, hey, I can now talk to 15 machines, I can go ahead and issue one command, and this is going to be a great way to install packages. This is going to be a great way to edit configuration files. This is going to be a great way to, you know, run my entire environment. Wrong. This is great for the one-off troubleshooting that you're doing across your environment. If you do have those scenarios where you do want to control multiple systems in a fairly convenient manner, look at configuration management, look at Chef, look at Puppet. It's by far the better way of doing any of this stuff. So, we looked at input redirection. Let's have some more fun with it. Here we're reading from the local mic. We're putting it on a remote machine. You'll have to customize dev DSP for whatever that is in your environment, but you can write it to the local output device, and the next thing you know, you're talking into your mic, and you're bugging someone else at their desk. If you don't like practical jokes, well, here's something terribly useful. You've got a CD-ROM in your local machine, and hey, you're writing the ISO file to another location. Great for virtualization environments. Likewise, if you don't particularly care, if you've got an Ultrabook that doesn't have a CD-ROM drive and don't particularly care, then you also have options for, hey, just grab the disk. I say forensic copy here. Of course, it's not going to be a super clean copy, but still, it's utility, it's options, it's fun. So we've done one file, cat the sample file, pipe it to a remote machine, write it to that file. Note, I don't want to say subtlety, but SSH, the cat command on host A, it's just picking up standard in. while standard N lives actually on our machine, and we pass it to SSH. SSH then carries it on and makes it available directly to the cat, and the cat then writes that to the file. So if we want to put one file on a remote machine, quick and dirty way of doing it. If we have multiple files, there's a quick and dirty way of doing that as well. Tar. Again, we're going to the remote machine, we're issuing this tar command, we're grabbing a whole bunch of files, we're piping it to SSH, and then it's passing it back. Now on the local machine, that pipe is then picked up by a tar command as well, and it's writing all those files locally. Note the tack character, the dash character for F to specify standard N for tar. But you can just simply let SSH do it. Very simple scenarios, mess around with this stuff, but here we're taking sample file, we're writing it to our default login location on host A. Here we're doing the same thing, we're renaming the file though. Here we're changing the directory, file name staying the same. Here we're doing a whole directory. In all these examples, I've got host A as a destination. We could just as easily say, pick up the file off of host A and copy it locally. So some fun to mess around with there. We can do this interactively with SFTP. It's great if you don't know exactly what you're copying, from where or to where. Gives you options for changing directories so you can pick up multiple files. So have fun with that. Alternatively, there's rsync, great for copying whole directories, and also rsync is beautiful if you're not aware of it. It'll diff the two locations so that you can copy just the differences or do that same rsync multiple days in a row to update your copy. SSHFS runs an SSH process in a background as a daemon so that you can effectively mount some portion of that remote machine on your local machine, you copy the files, it makes it a seamless integration between what you're seeing here and there. So we're copying files all over the place. Can we do it on schedule? Of course we can. And then of course the command would look like, hey, crontab e, look, we've got the SCP, we've got it going on. Hey, look, it's day one. Well, we just set it up today, that's why we're not seeing the files. Oh, well, I'll let it go. Maybe it'll automatically pick up. No, it didn't. Crap, I'm gonna have to resolve this. Still not there. Why are we still waiting? I'm sorry? Not an empty line at the bottom of the cron? No, actually, it's still waiting on a password. Question? We were waiting on the password. So, what do we do about passwords? Bingo, we've got keys. For those of you who are not familiar, SSH offers multiple login strategies. It can do public keys, it can do passwords, it can do GSS API if you want to get really fancy with it, so integrate smart cards and do all this other fun stuff. But here's an example of using keys. SSH keygen, we generate a key. In this example, we generate a key by name of foo. It then goes and creates foo and foo.pub. I'll note, we entered, just hit enter for the passphrase, so there's no passphrase on it. And then we get a fingerprint and random art image. Because these are big, long cryptographic numbers, we don't want to try and remember the whole thing. So the fingerprint and the random art image are great little comparison tools to figure out what the identity of that key is. Now that we have our keys, what do we do with them? Well, we've got foo, we've got foo.pub. Foo is ours forever and ever. We don't want to share it because it's our secret identity. Foo.pub, we're going to spam everyone with this because, well, we get paid to do it, I guess. We're going to take foo.pub, we're going to put it on the remote system. So line one, copy foo.pub up to gatekeeper. On gatekeeper, we log in there, we go to the .ssh directory. Inside .ssh, there's the authorized key files. We append the contents of foo.pub into that file. Boom. We can now log in without passwords because the keys are checked. Now, how many people have been paying attention? This is five commands. Can we do it in one line? I'm seeing head nods. Can I get a yes or no? Thank you. Anyone want to quote it? No, wait. you're thinking this. Yeah. So this is exactly what we're doing. This takes all everything that we've done heretofore. We just cat the file. We go into the remote machine. We add it to the end of our file. And there we go. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy to remember as long as you know what's going on. But it's even simpler than that. But why is it important to know that or how it actually works? Well, again, we want to know our tool. We want to know how our tool works. So even though SSH copy ID is available, mostly available, it's not actually available in Mac. So it's important to know how it works, what the component is there. Question. Okay. The comment was SSH copy ID. If he's running SSH on a non-standard port, then it can sometimes be difficult to use. I'm not sure if SSH copy ID accepts the standard arguments, but that would be something to investigate. But he commented further that, well, since you actually know what the mechanism is, if the SSH copy ID doesn't work because of whatever mechanism or whatever issues you're having, then, hey, it's not too hard to get around. Is there another question? Okay. Ah. Absolutely correct. Here we're actually copying the default. I do know in this case, thank you for pointing that out. Technically, to copy our foo key up, it would be SSH copy ID gatekeeper space dash F foo. Great pickup, by the way. Thank you. So now we copied our key. Hey, it says, go try it. We try it. And all of a sudden, note after SSH gatekeeper, no password request. It auto-negotiated that for us. So the comment was you can use both keys and passwords for double authentication. That is correct. That's a newer feature of SSH, I believe, and I'm not sure if that was... Well, I know specifically they 6.1 or 6.2, sometime in the last three releases, I can guarantee, they gave you multiple SSH options to specify also the order for what you specify in. Some people get paranoid. Great. I like paranoia. So now that we've mastered our passwordless login, this is where we started. This is great. This is really convenient. And now that we're celebrating around a beer, we're thinking about what we're doing, and we're thinking, oh, did we really want to do that? Because effectively, we've got some frickin' magic going on. The cron tab entry is totally outside of any other process that we want to, any other process that we have going on. So when something breaks, where's the cron tab entry in there? So if you do set up remote jobs, document them thoroughly. Document them inline. If you're doing some sort of log shipping where you need to examine this stuff, create a script that does the copy for us. It can have its keys there as well. But again, it's really, really easy to just get it done, implement it across cron and whatever else is going on, and then completely forget about it. So we just set up passwordless keys. Hey, fun. Who can use that passwordless key?
I can.
That's right. Exactly. Anybody can. So the two caveats here, well, first off, if you're actually you and you're using keys, use SSH agent. I didn't flesh this out as much in the slides as I should have, but SSH agent bash, starts you out with a new command line session. SSH is running in the background. Excuse me, SSH agent is running in the background. Do SSH key add. Boom, that loads your key to the SSH agent. Then whenever you hop the system, your key's already there. You only had to type the password in. Excuse me, you only had to type the password for the key in once. And then all of a sudden, it's still alive somewhere in the background with SSH agent. You can go to that machine as many times as you want to. You can go there automatically in your scripts. And your key's still protected, but you have that convenience. But if you're doing it on a remote basis, you still have to have SSH loaded. You still have to have SSH agent loaded. And so there's not much of an effective use case of just having a passwordless key and having SSH agent running all the time, running as root. So for security, what else can we do to lock this thing down? We have forced commands. Documentation for the forced commands is in the SSHD man page. There's a whole section for the authorized keys file. I would not think to look there, so when I went to go searching, it took me about 10 minutes, so if you should ever look for the documentation, that's where it's at. Also, if you really want to see super slick implementation of all this stuff as far as force commands and some of the magic that can be done with this, go look at Gitolite. Gitolite is a package for giving you more control over Git repos. And again, just the magic they do is wonderful. So here we've got our remote authorized keys file. We specified that anyone logging in with that key identity, this command is run. They log in, boom. They get the process list, and then they log back out. So going back to our file copy, we've now switched to rsync. The crontab entry shows the rsync running on our mirror machine on a periodic basis every night at 11, goes out, goes to the source machine, grabs the ISO archive directory, and starts dumping things into the archive/ISO. On the source machine, it's configured such that anytime this key ever connects, it only gets one thing. It gets the output of rsync. And while it's getting that, no pseudo terminal is created. So that's the no PTY. No agent forwarding is going on. No port forwarding is going on. No X11 forwarding is going on. So this one command is completely locked down. It will only ever get one thing. If you take that key, if you've snooped on my traffic and you've picked up that key and you try and log into the server, you're going to get a lot of binary output from rsync. So there's a little bit of subtlety going on there, at least in my mind, because, again, you can connect. You can give it issue whatever command you want. It doesn't really matter. This command is being kicked off by the SSHD daemon on that server. That output only makes sense in the context of rsync. So it's useful to have your rsync configured. But part of that subtlety is if you go on to mirror and you change that cron entry from ISO_archive as the files you're trying to pick up, say you want one subdirectory only, say I only want ISO_archive/Linux, then it's not going to matter. You still connect, the SSH daemon on source still kicks off that same rsync and puts it in that one location for you. So use it at your own risk. I'll note, when you're messing around, I'll fully endorse this as the way to run rsync. That being said, it can be a pain to set up. SSH-V or -VV or -VVV, as many of these as you want. Anyways, it gives you verbose output. And it'll actually show you what command is being sent. Rsync processes itself, realizes what connection it's making to the server, and then it's a good way to figure out what exact options your command needs in the authorized keys file on the host. Yes? That's the snippet of the key. So that's not an argument, that's just the key. It's much longer than that. I shortened it, put in the snippet. So just to be clear, they were asking what the line was. Similar variation of what we're doing. We can create a ad hoc remote tamper-resistant logging server. We've got a server that's receiving all the logs. We'll call it Log Cabin. In its authorized key file, anytime someone presents the key, dump the data they give us, well, dump date first to our log, path the log, and then dump the contents of whatever they're giving us in the same place. Your entries will be separated by date, and that's all we're recording. But then, again, we go to host, we echo foo, pass that to Log Cabin, boom, it gets recorded on that host for us. So an awful lot about authorized keys. What other config files do we have? SSH config. This is for your local client. This is how your local client behaves. When you type in SSH host, typically we're all thinking, because we haven't set up aliases, which are effectively what the host blocks are, we just think, well, I need to specify an IP or a remote host, and it works in that manner, but We can also specify hosts in our SSH config file, and then it gets aliased to what we specify here. There's some, as soon as I see a config file, I want to go ahead and create it in a most concise and most direct manner that I can. Defaulting does work. We have host star, and it specifies some default actions for everything that we specify. Every host that we connect to from this machine is going to receive those two options. But how are they receiving those? The rule is this. Every host section that matches will match. They match in order from top to bottom. The value that is used is the first value that it encounters. So if we're SSHing to host 172.28.19.14, it's going to match two blocks for us. It's going to match host star. It's going to match host star 172.28 star star. Going from the top of the file, it's going to apply a forward agent yes. It's going to apply permit local command yes from the host star block. It's then going to hit the second block, 172.28 star star. It's going to apply identity file, and then it is going to completely skip permit local command no. Because again, it matches the first value that it found, and it keeps that value. So if you're trying to build up some super complex thing, be aware that that's the order of precedence. Heretofore, we've gotten quite a bit about what we can do on this host, that host, bringing those hosts together in kind of magic ways. SSH is also a great tool for manipulating the network. So since we're going to be talking about networking stuff, can everyone here at least spell TCP/IP?
No.
Thank you very much. The presentation's over. So, if we're manipulating the network, ask me your questions, Bridgekeeper. I am not afraid. The three things we're specifying when we do a local forward, we're specifying the local port we're opening, we're specifying the host we're connecting to from the perspective of the host we're connecting to, and then we're specifying the port number we're connecting to. In our very simple example here, we've got two machines on that top bit. We've got SSH, we're connecting to host B. We take 5900, we're opening that up on the local machine, and all the traffic that hits 5900 on the local machine, send that on to the remote machine, it's port 5900. For convenience, 5900 is VNC. It's a graphical protocol. Boom. So if we open up our VNC client on host A, all the traffic, we're looking at the desktop of host B. Can we make two jumps? Can we cross two hosts to get our traffic? Yes, we can. This is a way of doing it. What about three jumps? Yes, this is a way of doing it. Do note, we've got the single ticks around the host C line, we've got double quotes around the host D line, and just because of escaping all those single ticks and double ticks, it's going to get complicated fast. Now, is it valid? Well, we'll discuss that in a second. So we can shorten it. We can make it really quick. Super fast reflexes, SSH host B, localhost 5900, pass it on to host C, same port. Now, was a triple hop contrived when we can do something like this? Yes and no. A triple hop, as we saw, is going to take the traffic and port forward on each host. So you're building that jump three times. This is sending it directly. But as a consequence of how it's sending it, SSH encrypts traffic. It's one of the things it does. Usually it's a side effect of what we've got going on, but sometimes we care that that encryption is happening. So if we're going from host A and we want our traffic to go to host C, well, right now, this big fat green arrow is the only part where that traffic is encrypted. So the triple hop is contrived, except if you're trying to protect the traffic en route the whole way. Now, are there better ways of doing that? SSL tunnels? I'll leave that open for debate. But it's not necessarily out of the realm of possibility that you want to do something like that. port forward. So we would be taking 5900, passing into 5900. Hey, they're just numbers. So if you want to, you can go ahead and remap all those. In this particular example, 443, that's SSL traffic, well, web SSL traffic. We specifically want to go ahead and remap this traffic because if we try and open up 443, we're going to get denied, right? Only root can open up ports lower than 1024. So here, we specifically remap the port. We can tack multiple of these together at the same time. 3306, it's MySQL traffic. We're going to host C, host D, host E because you're a super cool database developer and you've got databases all over the place. A problem with this is remembering the port orders and the port mappings that you've got going on. I'll note also from the previous slides, we had the big fat green arrow. Hey, we're only encrypting that big fat green part. But as a consequence, all that traffic going through there is going through and appearing as one single connection. So if you ever encounter an area where you're trying to obfuscate your traffic, then as a consequence, we are sending three different machines traffic through one connection that may or may not be convenient. So we've got 3306, 3307, 3308. We've got lots of ports, but pop quiz time. How many IP connections do you have on your local machine? Excuse me, how many IP addresses do you have on your local machine? One for each NIC, as many as you want. I like as many as you want. You have to have some effort to configure those. No, by default, you'll actually find that you can respond to 16 million. You've got 16 million configuration out of the box that you can talk to. Of course, we have the NIC address F0192.168.15. Hey, we've got that one. We specifically defined that one. We're going to get that one only. However, on Linux and Windows, you'll find any traffic you send to the entire /8.127.0.0.1 will get a response. 16 million. Okay. Excuse me. I'm excited about this. I'm super excited about this. I think it's wonderful. I think it's marvelous. This is my favorite SSH trick because what I didn't tell you earlier was the dash L option actually accepts four arguments, and it accepts local, or excuse me, the first one defaults to localhost. We didn't have to specify it earlier. Well, if we do, then this gives us some convenience. Localhost is just an alias. Localhost is an alias for 127.0.0.1. But in our connections, the important part is not to go to a distinct port, it's to go to a distinct IP address port combination. So we can do this instead. Why would this be advantageous? Well, this would be advantageous because if localhost is just an alias, then we can create our own aliases. So we've got our own aliases. We've got 02, 03, 04 is local 234. If you've got machines you connect to often, you can go ahead and give those names on our side. And then when you extrapolate it and add it in to the best, or excuse me, refactor the previous stuff, then all of a sudden you can have this SSH command connecting three different remote hosts. But instead of specifying a port on online connections and having to remember all those, you can just say, hey, MySQL host, BFF. And we're happy. So it makes it really concise and really convenient. And I think Conan agrees with me that that's an incredibly cool trick. We spent some time talking about local forwards. We also have remote forwards. The idea is effectively the same. Local forwards, we took local traffic, or we made it listen to the traffic on a local port from elsewhere. Remote traffic, dash R, does the reverse. We make a port open on the remote machine and then feed it local traffic. So here, on their remote machine, we open up port 2022, and then we pipe it back to our local host 22. Yes, question. Excellent. The question was, if you've already got an existing connection, is there a way to add more forwards? Yes, there is. And I've got slides on that, so stay tuned for another couple minutes. So we're opening up a remote forward, and here we're at home. It's me at home, and I SSH into my work machine. On that work machine, I open up 2022. I bring it back to my local machine, boom. And then later when I go into work, if I SSH into 2022, I'm actually, through the magic of the forward, opening up an SSH connection into my home machine. So pretty little graph, hopefully demonstrating that concept, boom. The effective results, hey, I've SSH'd in, boom. I see my machine at home. Kind of nice. With remote forwards, we also have four parameters. That first one, is the IP address we're binding to. We can bind to a public address and make this forward available to other machines on the network. Is your security team going to thank you? If you're the security team, who cares? But again, understand that their concerns are, well, we have firewall rules in place for a reason. We have this stuff locked down for a reason. You know, don't shoot yourself in the foot. So back to the gentleman's question, is there a way to open up these forwards dynamically on the fly? You've already got your session in place. You've already got a great deal of software running. You don't want to break all that down and restart it again. If you hit tilde capital C, you get a little SSH shell prompt. And here, just like we were on the command line, we can specify L, we can specify R. There's some other options we can specify, and boom. It adds it directly in. As soon as you press enter, it acknowledges that it built the forward, and then you're back on your local prompt. Aside from local forwards and dynamic forwards, which I haven't discussed yet, or even netcat forwards, which I've not discussed yet, you can do a couple other funky options. I'm not going to go on the list. The one I do want to pick out, though, this one is incredibly nice. This is the option permit local command. Bang, command, in this case, hostname. And all of a sudden, it spits that out, and I've run that command on my local machine, even though I've still got that entire context of that remote session up and running. Nothing's broken, but if I needed to grab one piece of information real quick, boom, there it is. This is, I'll hear it colloquially as netcat-like functionality. Basically, what it does is we're piping into and out of SSH, or even in this example, we've just connected to localhost 25 after connecting to localhost. So, again, trivial example. But, again, it opens up a connection where we can start typing directly on that remote port. How is this useful? Well, if you played around with Netcat, you can probably start answering that yourself. But here, I have a file, a good file. Unfortunately, well, they didn't like it. But take the file, pipe it into SSH. And then all of a sudden, we're writing directly to 25. The file was a spoofed email. We're now sending email commands directly to the remote server, directly on port 25. It takes it, boom, mail sent. So earlier, we had this going on. We had local forwards for 8080 for port 80. We had 8443 for 443. This convenience, this has worked. If you're trying to set up a web daemon, if you're trying to set up another process where you just want to test whether those ports are working, this is a great way of doing it. It's not so great when you're trying to do it dynamically. Yes, we have the SSH shell, but doing that every time, remembering your port forwards, what numbers have I used, what numbers have I not used, it can be problematic. So we have dynamic forwards. The dynamic forward, it only takes a port number option, 2020 in this case, and it opens up a SOX proxy. The entire SSH client has a whole SOX proxy emulation layer built in. It opens that up. In that white window, we've got our browsing configuration. We configure our browser to point at the SOX proxy we set up. Then all the traffic we send then gets carried through our SSH connection to that remote machine. And what happens to our traffic? So I'm not saying you should do this from work. I'm not saying you should do this from work. But if you did this from work, then all of a sudden the traffic that you're going to Facebook or whatever else isn't going to work. It's actually going to your home machine and then going forward. Now, In this particular example, I'm sitting at a cafe, internet cafe, maybe a hotel, maybe an airport, maybe something like that. These institutions often have lockdown filters in place to stop traffic from going willy-nilly. Well, they often need DNS to run. So they usually don't block DNS. So if you set up your home server to answer SSH on port 53, then all of a sudden, hey, you can go home, you get your SOX box, you're dedicating all your traffic, and maybe, just maybe, I'm not saying you have, you've circumvented their procedure and maybe you're not being billed. So this is Linux Conference. I think we've all appreciated what we've seen so far. Sometimes you're stuck in a desert though, and do we have this functionality elsewhere? Yes, we do. PuTTY, PuTTY Tray, Kitty, Cygwin, WinSCP. WinSCP, love it. It's a graphical utility for messing around with files. It's really slick, mess around with it. Cygwin, I really like. It's kind of a bear to set up, but it's a complete Linux environment. It's a complete shell environment for messing around on Windows. So where do we go if we want to learn more? OpenSSH, it's the de facto standard. Pretty much everyone uses SSH. Everyone uses OpenSSH. There's instrumented SSH, there's Tectia's servers, there's the Windows stuff. They all have some interesting stuff, but OpenSSH is the bleeding edge. They have biannual releases. Go here, read about them. Lots of cool stuff coming out. So, who here likes SSH and has a pretty nifty trick to share? Gentlemen.
Not a trick, but there's an excellent book by a local author in the Detroit area. His name is Michael Lewis, and the book is SSH Mastery.
Okay, he's sharing a great book to learn more, SSH Mastery, Michael Lewis. He's in the Detroit area, you said? Excellent. Please remind me after the show. I'll write that down. Questions? Comments? Yes? Yeah, so the comment was the SSH command line, the escape character is how it's referred to in the documentation. There's other things you can do with that. If you've got a locked SSH connection, he's suggesting tilde dot kills that connection. Again, the reason why that works, it's actually sending the command to the local client rather than the remote machine. So if you've got a hung sessions, it's a great way of killing it. Yes, thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so the comment was, I'll follow up on the SSH copy ID, perhaps using single ticks. I know, just to extend that comment, SFTP accepts a lot of these same options as well. However, it accepts them through the dash O command. So SFTP host, and then you want to do some port forwarding magic at the same time you have your SFTP connection open. Well, it may or may not like, I'm riffing here, it may or may not like local forwards on that part of the command line, but you can still specify those by specifying dash O, dash option, and then you got to be a bit verbose here. The dash O option, it likes to see stuff as if you had put it in SSH config. So that's probably a good way of getting around the copy ID trick as well. I'll also note the SSH config works just as well when you're SFTPing and SCPing as SSHing. So really mess around with an SSH config file if you've got some hosts you really go around to, because it can save you a lot of time and money. Questions? Yes. Great comment. How many people here like Screen? How many people here like Tmux? Wow. You guys haven't mobbed them yet. Screen and Tmux, thank you for mentioning. Screen and Tmux are both great utilities. What these do is they open up a console on the remote machine that you've connected to. So it saves your context. It saves everything that you're doing. If you need to open up multiple shells, then you don't have to open up multiple SSH sessions. You connect to that remote host, type in screen, TMUX, whichever, and then all of a sudden you can go on about your business. You can then disconnect those sessions and leave them running on that remote machine. Or if you get accidentally disconnected, they still stay running on those remote machines, so then you can then later reconnect from home, from a coffee shop, wherever you are, and pick up exactly where you were. TMUX is a little bit fancier. It's a little bit newer. Screen, I believe, does some of this as well, but if you want to set up multiple windows and break them in half so that your TMUX session is showing you four windows instead of one, it's got some fancier magic, but still good stuff. Question? Yeah, the gentleman was saying his favorite feature is reconnecting to an existing session, and then he mentioned the dash X option for screen, so that two people are looking at the same screen. That's incredibly nice. Two real useful tricks on that is, again, why would you want to share code? The first comment would be is if you're doing any form of pair programming, or if you're trying to, someone's trying to troubleshoot and they can't get anywhere, then all of a sudden you're connecting to the same session, you're seeing what they type in. It's incredibly great on that. Also, a more down-to-earth more down-to-earth skill for that. If you're ever giving a presentation where you're directly beside the screen and can't read what's on it, then you can actually open up two terminal windows, connect to the same screen session from the same side, and then all of a sudden you're typing here and it's appearing here, and you don't have to kill yourself typing. So yeah, screen is a great adjunct utility. Screen is the next hour though. So more questions. Cluster SSH is pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, excellent. Question. Well, so with an unencrypted, so the comment is, what are the dangers of an unencrypted personal key? The dangers are that is it's sitting on your box, on this disk, completely unencrypted. Any system administrator comes along, I work as a sysadmin, I cross many systems all day long, anyone coming along to that key can pick it up and use it and carry it wherever they want to. So it's not necessarily...
You're talking about the risk of a compromised
privacy. Yes. Yeah. Questions? Yes. It depends. The question was, does SSH copy ID safely append to the existing nodes, or does it truncate and clobber whatever you already have? It depends, yes. Far more useful that way. Questions? Well, thank you very much. If you have any questions, come on up to the show.